Cindy spent over 20 years in public accounting, including 7 years as audit partner with Coopers & Lybrand PricewaterhouseCoopers. Her clients included Fortune 500 companies in manufacturing, distribution, higher ed, nonprofit, and financial services. In addition, Cindy was CFO of a consumer packages roll-up company. She managed its IPO and eventual sale. She has served on over 30 nonprofit organizations, either as a consultant or a board member. She's currently the chair-elect for the Society of International Business Fellows, an international membership organization for C-level executives. Cindy is author of A Guide to Nonprofit Board Success, Answering the Call of Leadership, published by Prager. Is it available on Amazon?
It is.
It's available on Amazon. Okay. And so thank you very much, Cindy, for the case, and I turn it over to you as moderator.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I enjoyed my group. So I guess the first order of business is for each of the groups to report out, right?
Yes.
So why don't we start with that?
Group one, Brian, that was your group you asked.
Yes. And I'm going to be the moderator. It was Brian and three Johns. So it wasn't confusing at all for us. But we looked at it and it was an interesting case. I think a couple of things. One, there's a lot of work to do. Nobody's doing the work, but this was really focused on the special committee that work wasn't getting done. We read the case and it appeared as though nobody on the committee realized that we were potentially close or actually in a crisis mode around a balanced budget, that there was either a shortfall or even a loss. And I think that's part of the challenge too, like the committee maybe not even having the visibility initially. So we thought the best thing to do was first and foremost, get with the overall chair of the board, walk through the circumstances as we see them, make sure that we had their support, their alignment as to the approach that we would propose to our committee. And that approach would be first to actually use the knowledge of the treasurer being the only one that had access to the budget or knowledge of the budget, and there was a potential shortfall or loss, calling that out to our subcommittee members as a crisis, that it's an operations issue, meaning we early on established roles and responsibilities, and you know, everybody on this committee was supposed to have a project, they were supposed to report out. That hasn't been occurring, and as a result, this other issue is now bubbling up, and that we, in fact, need to have a balanced budget and we need to make sure that we have operations in a sustainable, scalable way. So we'd like to put forward or put in place metrics that we can all align to and agree to that's going to ensure that we can measure and sustain what it is we've been brought together to do. Also agree on the expectations going forward. So maybe do a reset of, hey, as a part of this committee specifically, this is what the goals, the objectives are, here are what the expectations are. And now, if they weren't aware of us not being at budget and potentially having a shortfall, that awareness is something that now we can use that as a catalyst and say, hey, listen, we understand everybody's busy. And if you're not willing, able, or wanting to do what we've suggested, we understand if you want to step away from this committee, we'd still see value for you on the board, maybe in a different capacity. But this is what we're going to need for this committee's membership. And there potentially could be some self-selection out, and that would enable new blood to come in and then put forward the plan to actually get to a balanced budget and make sure it's sustainable and scalable. So that was our working hypothesis. I'll be very, very eager to hear what the other groups have to say and if we were on target or not.
Group two.
That was Babs, Ryan, Ingrid Jacobs, Jim Shields, Maria Jones.
Hi, I took notes today for group two. So
Thank you for announcing the names. And so with our conversation, I think we really try to look at the committee as a whole and do a deconstruction of what is their makeup today? How are they recruiting? Because we did see some lack of aligned skill sets that match the need. So some of the things we talked about were firstly, the term. So one thing we wanted to confirm that alum of the org had no term limitations. Is that correct?
No, there are term limitations. That was a typo. So everybody gets 2 3-year terms. I say, but 2 is not guaranteed. So you do have an opportunity to make a change after that first 3-year term.
Okay, that's helpful. So we had a question about that. Thank you for answering. And so the next thing we noticed is that with regard to commitment, that was a strong thing that we felt like was missing with regard to assigning and understanding the commitment for the role. People seemed to enjoy the prestige of being on the board, but didn't seem to be committed to doing the work. That yielded a couple of observations. One being that the interviewing process, we felt needed to have more inquiry to better fit a two-way conversation, not only just stating what's required, but also getting inquiry to understand if that particular candidate would be a good right fit for the board position. Secondly, we looked at, for those who have been on the board for a significant amount of time, giving them an option, especially the senator, to recommend a replacement and give them emerita status as an option for continued board participation. And through that status, they could recommend grants and endowments that would help the organization. And then also we looked at, with regard to work, task force being leveraged. So where other more savvy or skilled individuals could participate as part of a task force, but help support the board members. And then also when we're getting back to defining the role on the board, getting back to finances was, we recognized that there was no fundraiser subject matter expert on the board that was recognized. So we wanted to understand and have that as part of the recruitment process and understand what would their required donation with their seat. That is very common for not-for-profits. And so making sure that that's being reinforced here. Additionally, with the committees, we recognized that the committees had no line of delineation for the roles or responsibilities, and then also that there was no skills matrix with consideration on that committee participation. So really, again, aligning the right people to the right purposes and to the right roles for success. Additionally, it came up that if gaps were perceived with regard to skills, that additional board seats be added based on those skill gaps. And then also we questioned and wanted to limit committee participation to 2 or 3 focus committees. It seemed like all of the board members were spread across all the committees. And so we saw that as a source for potential burnout and lack of action because they're spread a little thin. Now, one thing we thought of and came up with, the team said self-assessment and awareness is always key as being a board member. So the hot topic was the treasurer could be giving an instance of giving the chair the notice that it's kind of time for them to go because maybe they need a fresh amount of leadership to take the board over with fresh eyes. So that's something to come up. And then where we kind of ended, we ran out of time, but to talk about the events. So we felt the events should be restructured to be in a situated where the events cover themselves with the event fees. So restructuring the event fees so the events actually pay for themselves, not just having events for the look and feel of the org. So that's a summation of what we talked about in our group.
Very good. 3.
Cindy, 3 was the group that you were in, right?
That's me. It's me.
That's Mindy.
We were looking at a very dysfunctional organization, and we were trying to figure out kind of what some steps could be taken to kind of corral what's going on, understand what's going on. And some of our suggestions are as follows. One is to hire an outside consultant to help define the organization's purpose going forward so that everybody's on the same page in terms of a plan and what they need to do. Once there was this analysis done, was suggested that the chair meet with each board member to really explain what the organization needs to do going forward and if they want to be part of it. So to really get some buy-in from those people to see if this is where they want to be and if they want to continue to be involved. Think that an analysis of the programming, what works, what doesn't work, would be really helpful along with what the consultant is doing as it ties together. We also suggested that the chair sit down with the finance committee and with the treasurer, because it seems like there's a lot going on, they're overloaded, and really try to sort out what the treasurer is saying about the overworked employees and about what's, you know, the shortfall and how they can manage their assets better. And then also, ultimately, there should be a strong budget and a strong commitment to a budget, that there's a real budget. Everybody understands what it is, that it's adjusted, but that they really run it like a real organization. Did I miss anything, Jerry, Jim? Anything else? Jerry, you're muted.
Jerry, you're muted. Yeah.
We talked about the willingness to confront each board member and whether or not they want to buy in. And it seems to me that it's a fairly dramatic change that's coming. And I thought that was an important element.
I think that's about it.
Four
was the very small group. It was Robert and Bob.
And myself, Scott.
Oh, Scott, okay.
And I was elected to speak, and then I had to go run to the printer and print this up and reread it again. But I was elected because I am sort of living this. I'm on the something called the Dean's Advisory Council at Johns Hopkins, and I'm on the board of directors of the Alumni Association of Fordham Law School in New York. And so I think the easiest thing is just to kind of run through what we talked about as we go through the document. So right off the bat, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money. That's like, you know, Hopkins had a $1 billion campaign. So in my experience, a lot of the funding for these types of groups are partially or even majority funded by the university. So when you join an alumni association, you pay alumni dues. And then if you want to be on the board, then you're expected to make a larger gift. But the gift's not to the alumni association, it's to the university. So there should be, you know, right off the bat, there should be a revisiting of the funding sources and whether there is more money in the budget to replace this 20% shortfall, because this is how you identify major donors. Is you have events and you have alumni activities to go out and try to re-engage with some of these folks. They talk about several events and funded by sponsorships and small fees. There was a mention about fees. Fees are a little tricky at alumni events because people feel like I'm giving money. Like, wait a minute, I gave you money, now I have to give you more money. So that's a little bit of a third rail in my experience, but it's certainly worth talking about. It's good to know their term limits. Sometimes that takes care of itself. I'm an emeritus board member of the Fordham Law Alumni Association. I just spent a whole bunch of time on the strategic plan. So I don't get to vote, but I'm still very active and I'm happy to do that, regardless of whether or not I'm a voting member of the Alumni Association. So that's I think that's an excellent way to give people a carrot to stay involved, and then you can weed them out if they don't stay involved. New sources of revenue was mentioned. I mean, it's typically, you know, high net worth individuals who are willing to to make donations. And so that's both these institutions spend a lot of time trying to figure out who those people are and to engage with them. This treasurer piece is confusing to me. So this is an elected treasurer role. Like, why? Yeah. That person should not be spending, you know, countless hours. That's nuts. So first of all, the Alumni Association typically doesn't have a ton of money. And so they are, this should just be an oversight. There should be a finance committee. I'm on the finance committee for one of these organizations, and you just, it's oversight. You're looking at you know, the dues in, any additional revenue that's coming into the Alumni Association, and then programming fees and whatever the shortfall is going to be. The other piece, again, and it's mentioned here, you know, the finance committee has responsibility for overseeing financial reporting of the association, not the university. So the university is going to have people who are really skilled at this, and they should be involved. For non-academic institutions, I'm on a couple of nonprofit boards. That's a different thing, right? You have some money, and there's some investment strategy, and you figure out whether you want to just stick it in some interest-bearing account or whether you want to do something more sophisticated. Again, in my experience, you financial professionals, asking them to do this on their own time, and it actually puts pressure on them. I'm not a big fan of that, but it's not uncommon. We talked about the investment professionals. We talked about the 20% decline. This is interesting. The employees feel overworked and underappreciated. Well, they're employees of the university. The Alumni Association doesn't employ anyone. So that's the university's problem. If there are employees of the university who are feeling overworked, then it's not up to the Alumni Association to deal with that. It's the university. They are their employer. And so that should just be raised to the president. In terms of this really interesting issue with the state senator and the major donor, emeritus is a good approach, but you also have a DE&I issue here that's, you know, very, very important. So you have to, if you're going to go out and try to find somebody to replace the state senator or the female executive, you really want to factor that in. You cannot end up with a board of a you know, academic institution, Alumni Association that is all men, all white men. Just can't. The optics are horrific. So only other thing I might have missed. Let's see, university. Yeah, the fundraising. Oh, there was fundraising subject matter expertise. Any college or university should have a development officer on staff, and that's their job. And so they're just liaising with the alumni and with the Alumni Association. But that's your subject matter expert, and every institution should have at least one person whose job is to raise money. And that was about it. Anything I missed, Bob or Robert? Great, thank you.
And Cindy, we had a group in the vestibule, people who were having technology problems, and there were five of us, and it was Craig, Mark, Peter, Bill, and me. So Craig, why don't you report in for our vestibule group?
Sure. So our group focused more on the behaviors and responsibilities, as it were, of the two sort of wayward members. One of the suggestions that we came up, and it's been brought up by others, is having a board self-evaluation applied to the committee, where in one of the aspects of that was that it would be almost like a 360 degree assessment, where each of the board members assesses the performance of the other, and then the chair sits down with each member and shares with that member what the other board member's opinion is, not naming any names. And she recommended that through her own experience. That seems to work quite well. It was really about, you know, reminding them of their responsibilities and their roles. You know, they're two of which are, you know, attending meetings, number one, and fundraising. And we believe that there may be some people on the board who just were in the committee who are there for the prestige and the honor, which was emphasized many times in the case. And perhaps either they aren't aware that their attendance is below or beneath what is expected, or they may have been on the board for so long that they just are losing interest It's not important, it's not a priority. And so one of the suggestions was annually, if not more frequently, reminding people what the responsibilities are as a board member and specifically with the committee and specifically with respect to adequate attendance and fundraising. One thing we didn't discuss that I was thinking about just as I was jotting some notes down here is it may not be clear what is expected in terms of attendance. Some members may feel that it's okay to miss a, I don't know how frequently they are, miss a monthly meeting or miss two or miss three. So we felt that they should have certainly established some expectations for what that attendance should be. And again, revisit the, what do they term them? The assigned revenue generating opportunities to make sure everybody is clear on what those are and affirmatively buys into or affirmatively says, yes, I will commit to attendance minimums and I will commit to my revenue fundraising commitments. Let me ask the others on my team here if I've missed anything.
No, I think that's pretty good. I mean, I think Scott raised some interesting questions just in terms of the structure of how, you know, an alumni organization gets funded and staffed and so forth. And I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that I thought was missing and you sort of hit on it was it was unclear where among the board and the committee structure where the fund development function lay. I mean, to my experience, just having it in a finance and audit committee, which is really just there for oversight, you know, is really not the right place. And kind of this hand waving in terms of, you know, identify some potential donors and then who's going to go out and take responsibility for, you know, knocking on the doors. So I thought that was a big issue. And I mean, I think that the board self-assessment is maybe one of the best ways to actually get people to reflect on how they are contributing to the board, because it does require some self-reflection, whether that assessment is, you know, of the board as a whole or, you know, in yourself as an individual director. But it seems to me that's a good way to get people to focus on what is their contribution. Are they living up to the expectations, you know, that are in the description of board responsibilities?
Okay, very good. I appreciate all the comments. I will share that this case is an amalgamation of a number of nonprofit situations that I have found myself in as a leader of a board as well as consulting. So any one board is probably not quite as bad as what this case portrayed, in all honesty. A couple of themes that I think are important that you all brought out. One is the responsibility for financial development. I did not make that part for fund development. I did not make that part of the case and wish I had, but generally most boards I'm involved with explain or encourage the entire board to have a role. There's different roles you can play in financial development, but you don't all have to be an asker, but you do all have to be a promoter, be a networker, et cetera. It is critical to find the proper role, as several of you mentioned, for board members. And in the two examples that I gave, the one board member, the CEO, I had the conversation with her and she said, you know what, this is not the right time in my life. And when I posed it to her, I asked for her suggestion as to how we could get her more engaged. And she said, you know what, I thought when I agreed to serve that I'd have the time, Well, then I got promoted to chief general counsel. So I don't have the time. So I would like to step down. That worked out well. In the case of the senator, basically at the end of his 3-year term, he realized that he wasn't able to attend, and he did not re-up for a second 3-year term. But I think we need to focus on how we get these people passionate enough so that they make the commitment. And that's one of the challenges that when I do orientation for boards, particularly for committee chairs, is how do you make it, I'm going to use the word fun, but how do you build that passion, camaraderie? And certainly Zoom calls, it's very difficult. You want every committee member to know that if they don't fulfill their responsibility, that they're letting their friends, their in some cases new friends that they value down. I think another way to encourage engagement is to perhaps almost have a training ground before somebody goes on a board. So you need to have worked on a particular project and gotten passionate about the organization before you recruited to come on a board. Our group, group four, I thought made a great point. And that is, are we expecting too much of our volunteers? Are there things that the employees should be doing? Do we need to take the resources and really invest in more staff? Are we being realistic about what we can expect of this caliber of volunteers? And a lot of organizations I've been involved with recently have stepped back and said, wait a minute, you know, it's not working to expect volunteers to do, to be worker bees to the point that the leaders, it becomes a non-paid job for them, because we're just not going to be able to get them to serve. Okay, next point is times have changed. And, you know, employees have to be a greater focus. There's, you know, we've all heard about how hard it is. And I asked Marianne about how successful she is to get employees. I recently sat in on a presentation that said instead of customer focus, we really needed at this point to be employee focused. Because if we're not employee focused, then you're never going to be able to be customer focused. So making sure that our employees are taken care of, meeting with the university. And I should point out that the $1 billion in my example was what the entire university raised, and only about 30 million only went to the alumni association. But still, I thought everybody's point, or several of your points about, you know, getting the employees incentivized and, you know, properly staffed up. The transparency is so critical, and the entire board has fiduciary responsibility for the financial crisis that this organization is in. And so absolutely the point about increasing transparency and ensuring that everyone has knowledge of the crisis is critical. Most of the boards are pretty successful in being budget focused. That's different though than what I often see, where the board does a strategic plan, comes up with all these great new initiatives, and then has this column of resource needs, and then tosses it to the finance committee and says, hey, okay, your problem. And it should not be that way. And the point about evaluating the programs, do we really need all those programs? In the case of one institution, we had a wonderful program that really did engage more alumni than had ever been engaged and clearly was a critical part of the campaign's success. However, it was very staff intensive. So we had to make the decision to not do it every year. So once we established the tradition, but you know, that's an example of evaluating a program. You don't have to not do the program. You have to decide, you know, do we have to do it every year? I love the comment about matching skill sets. Most of the organizations I'm involved with, the governance committee is pretty good at that. What they're not, and they're also pretty good about having the conversation about what the expectations are and their responsibilities as to attendance and fundraising. It's interesting though, when somebody is looking at a prestigious board, they say, oh yeah, I'll do it, but then they don't make it the priority that they should. So your comment about reminding them regularly of their responsibilities and the expectations and doing the self-assessment. In my book, I actually recommend three types of assessments. One is an annual board assessment. One is a self-assessment. And the other is a board meeting. You know, why are board members or committee members, do they not see the value in attending? You really have to ensure that your leadership is motivating them and building passion and excitement about their roles. I love the emeritus status. I recommend that a lot. And I love the fact that, Scott, that you're as active as emeritus. Often I see emeritus trustees reported out to and asked to write checks, but they're really not engaged.
So I was looking forward to being not engaged and I got dragged back in, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
And in the case of the finance committee in particular, it's often you get pulled back in. I know I have gotten pulled back in on that role too. The last comment I want to make is on the self-funding of events. And it doesn't always work. I would love for all events to be sustainable. And that's when you go to the university and you say, hey, if I charge what it costs me to, you know, have a cocktail party, it's going to be $150 and nobody's going to show up. And we've tried it every way. However, let me tell you who can attend these cocktail parties and the impact that they can have on your endowment. So, you know, let's take some of the university's development dollars and help fund that. Any questions, comments? Feel free to disagree with me.
My role is timekeeper. We have 5 minutes, so there's time for a question.
Everybody is on mute.
Robert has his hand up. Yeah, Robert's got his hand up.
Just a quick one. Thank you, Cindy. Great discussion. As I understand it, this is the Alumni Association Board. Do we in fact, or and do many of them have too many people? to where good governance and effective governance, it just doesn't work because you've got 20, 30, 40 people. Scott and I were talking about this a little bit. I was on an association board up until recently, and we had somewhere in the 40 to 50 range, which was completely unwieldy.
Way, exactly.
So the executive committee was the one that was actually, there were four senior folks, all volunteers, but they were basically the decision-making body, and they took their decisions to the board to let them know, but it wasn't, they didn't ask for permission. They basically informed the board, which made decision-making better. But what are you seeing and what makes sense?
Yeah, I'm seeing things go in waves, and absolutely 40 is too many. And in one alumni association, we took it from 36 down to 24. And that has worked a whole lot better. Another board, we needed the money. And we found that it was the board members and the expectation was set. So we took the board size up. However, as you were alluding to, Robert, we had a larger executive committee, and the executive committee, which has 12 people on it, they really were the board, are the board, because it's still functioning that way. The full board strictly has responsibilities to meet twice a year. The executive committee meets about every other month, okay? And very different organizations. The second one's a membership organization that wanted to ensure they had representative from all regions, states, et cetera. So there was a reason to have that larger board. But it's fascinating to see trends. But at the moment, I would say that the trend is for smaller boards being more effective.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy, for a very interesting case that sparked a lot of discussion and good participation tonight.
So. And this is what the book looks like.
Oh, okay. Hold it up so we can see it.
Commercial.
You can find it on Amazon.
Yep. Thank you.
That's great. Next month is November. We never want to compete with Thanksgiving, but I forgot to look and see which Thursday it is, but you'll get a notice from us for our next seat at the table meeting. And Cindy, again, thank you so much for a very excellent case and a good discussion. I think everyone appreciated it. Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care, Mindy.
Hi. You too. How's everything going?
Good. I got to run. I got to go to class.
Oh, wow. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.